The poem by Walt Whitman suggests that everything we encounter becomes part of us, and that we carry all of our past experience with us into new situations. It's an especially interesting fact for Unitarian Universalists to ponder, because most of us are come-outers. We have come out of other religious traditions. And we carry with us into this denomination a great variety of specific religious experiences, both positive and negative. One of the most important tasks we face as Unitarian Universalists is a kind of sorting out of our experiences of religion. We need to clarify what it is that we have found here, what religious values and experiences we wish to bring with us from our earlier lives, and what we choose to leave behind. Most of us are clearest about the last one. We are usually very vocal about the kinds of religion we want no part of. And that's, I think, what Stuart was talking about in his reading for the chalice lighting. We tend to forget that there were also some positive influences toward freedom of thought and toward the human values we hold now. Those positive influences may or may not have occurred in churches, but they were of a religious quality. And we need to honor those past experiences and consciously bring them with us into our present search. As searchers, we have another tremendous need, and that is for kindred spirits. We need to know not only that we are not the only ones on this questioning road, but also that we are not the only ones to arrive at certain heretical and unorthodox insights. As UUs, we love to sift through history and claim all the mavericks and heretics as wise men and women who were precursors of our own views. Well, it's an important task. It gives us a sense of continuity with creative and unusual people of many times. This morning, I thought we might work a bit on both of these tasks, the personal and the historical. In 1945, at a place called Nag Hammadi in Upper Egypt, near a mountain full of caves, a man was digging for a particular kind of soil. In digging out a boulder, he unearthed a large pottery jar. Thinking it might contain gold, he smashed it and emptied out the contents. No gold, but a whole collection of papyrus books bound in leather. After years of black market sales, smuggling, and political intrigue, the collection was finally assembled in a museum in Cairo, and copies made available to scholars. The actual books have been dated to the 4th century and are copies of scriptures used by Gnostic Christians. Their ideas were vehemently attacked and labeled heresy by the growing Orthodox Christian Church, which in that century became the official religion of the Roman Empire. It appears that someone hid the heretical texts, hoping to reclaim them later. They remained safely buried until 1945. As Elaine Pagels points out in her book, if they had been discovered 1,000 years ago, or even a few hundred years ago, they would surely have been burned as heretical. At a personal level, the Gnostic Christian writings set me to thinking about my own years within Christianity and the whole question of what I choose to bring with me from that experience and what I choose to leave behind. I'd like to share some of those reflections with you and take some time for you to share some similar reflections with each other. And I'd also like to tell you some of the ideas the Gnostic Christians had, which made them heretics, and perhaps kindred spirits for us. Think, if you will, of your own past religious journey. What values and beliefs and attitudes from the past do you choose to reject? What is the most important rejection of a belief or value that has occurred in your life? Think now of the past values and beliefs and influences you look upon as positive, as nourishing the free mind and independent spirit that has brought you to this place at this particular time. What beliefs or values do you choose to retain, to bring with you into the future? What is the most important belief you wish to retain? Now turn to someone near you and share those reflections. What beliefs you have rejected and what you choose to retain. And when I ring the gong, it'll be time to return. Way back in the 1950s, when I was a theological student at Drew University, liberal Methodist, Nell Morton, who was a professor there, asked me one day in her lovely Tennessee accent, which it is totally beyond me to imitate, "Shirley, what church do you go to?" "The Episcopal Church," I said. Her mouth fell open, her eyes widened, and she said, "What? You can't! That's not possible." I think that may have been the day I was arguing in her class that we should expand the Bible, open up the canon, and put some new life in it. The rigid doctrines and attitudes and structures of the churches sat very lightly with me. My attitude was that most of it had little to do with Christianity as Jesus might have meant it to be. It didn't surprise me at all to learn that most theological doctrines were the result of arbitrary decisions made for political reasons. The reason I stayed in the Episcopal Church for about 30 years of my adolescent and adult life was that I was committed to some values and attitudes which I persisted in labeling Christian. From my mother, who considered herself a Christian but would have nothing to do with organized religion, she considered all churches citadels of hypocrisy. From her, I absorbed the strange idea that what mattered about religion was how you lived your life. It was Jesus, she said, who healed on the Sabbath, who dined with publicans and sinners, who taught that the stranger who stops to help is more virtuous than the priest who fails to stop. And Jesus would have the same problems today with self-righteous churchgoers that he had in his own day with the scribes and Pharisees and money changers. And I have no quarrel with that kind of Christianity. It molded my values, it became part of my bones, and I choose to bring that with me. My mother had another odd idea which she passed on to me and which I definitely choose to retain. She did not believe in missions. Although she knew little about other religions, she greatly admired some of the ancient pagan writers, the Greek dramatists, and the Latin poets. And she assumed that Christianity had no corner on religious truth. From my father, who went to church every Sunday, I absorbed the liberal traditions that the Bible was an ancient set of books which could not be accepted as literal truth, that science and religion could be reconciled, and that such stories as that of the resurrection of Jesus or his virgin birth had to be understood in psychological or sociological terms. For years, I had no quarrel with that liberal tradition in which I was nurtured. But at theological school in the 1950s, the crucial word in our religious lives was relevance. How to make the ancient gospel relevant to modern life. People, we said, were not asking the right questions. I began to understand all the centuries-old theological debates which gave rise to the particular words I repeated every Sunday. But what could those issues possibly mean to people in the modern world? Finally, about halfway through my early theological education, I asked the crucial question, what does it mean to me? I knew the words, I even knew their history. I had read large sections of the New Testament in Greek and had speculated about the implications of different ways of translating particular words. I had often discussed the relevance of Christianity to modern life, but I had not really considered its relevance to my life. It was in the process of psychotherapy that I discovered what was to be for me the essence of religion, an encounter with my own potential and my own demons, an encounter which occurred within the context of a human relationship. Suddenly, the Sunday liturgy took on new meaning, relevance. Come unto me, all ye that travail and are heavy laden, and I will refresh you. I was refreshed. I was finding a new life. I labeled it a Christian experience. So I repeated the familiar words on Sunday, going through an elaborate cerebral process of translation, remembering the history, and feeling the connections between a new life in Christ and my own experience in psychotherapy. Professionally, I moved into the world of psychology, and I wondered over the years how many other people sat in church translating ancient stories into modern equivalents in their own experience. For me, the issue no longer was how to make an ancient story relevant, but how to lift up that which is religious in our own lives today. For many years, I didn't know there was a denomination where that task was central. It wasn't until 1972 that I visited a Unitarian fellowship and knew that I had found my real church home. I left the Episcopal Church because I found a religious movement which actively acknowledges that truth has been proclaimed not only by Jesus, but by other religious teachers, and more importantly, that it is proclaimed today in obscure places, if only we have ears to hear and eyes to see. I leave behind churches which try to limit truth to one particular revelation. There were other reasons, too. I became increasingly frustrated with the authoritarian structure of the church, with its hierarchy and its liturgical demands for what I considered unhealthy, submissive behavior. And as a woman, I became more and more aware of the sexist symbolism and practices of Christianity. I needed a church community which had a commitment to a more democratic processes in its organization, and one that would acknowledge women as the equals of men. Well, among the startling heresies proclaimed by the Gnostic Christians of the 4th century, is the notion that humanity created God. Humanity created God. And so from its own inner potential, discover the revelation of truth. The Greek word gnosis, of course, means knowledge. For Gnostics, exploring the psyche became a religious quest. They believed that the psyche bore within it the potential for liberation or destruction. These words are from the Gospel of Thomas, and they are attributed to Jesus. He says, "If you bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will save you. If you do not bring forth what is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you." According to the Gnostics, most people live in oblivion, unconsciousness, and so self-knowledge is crucial. In another text, Silvanus, the teacher, says, "Knock on yourself as upon a door, and walk upon yourself as a straight road." The Gospel of Truth says, "Say then from the heart that you are the perfect day, and in you dwells the light that does not fail, for you are the understanding that is drawn forth." Well, several interesting implications follow from this central focus on self-knowledge. Any person may achieve enlightenment and at that point becomes the equal of her teacher. Authority then is derived from self-knowledge and not from one's position in a hierarchy. As Pagels points out, this self-knowledge offers nothing less than a theological justification for refusing to obey the bishops and priests. Gnostic Christians refused to acknowledge the authority of the hierarchy, and they rotated leadership in their churches, operating on a more democratic model. Bishop Irenaeus complains that when the Gnostics met, all the members first participated in drawing lots. Whoever received a certain lot was designated to take the role of priest. Another was to act as bishop. Another would read the scriptures for worship. And others would address the group as prophets, offering extemporaneous spiritual instructions. The next time the group met, they would throw lots again so that the persons taking each role changed continually. Instead of ranking their members into superior and inferior orders within a hierarchy, they follow the principle of strict equality. Another implication of the Gnostic view is that since both men and women seek self-knowledge, divinity is imagined in both masculine and feminine terms. Gnostic literature contains such lines as these: "I am thought that dwells in the light, she who exists before the all. I move in every creature, I am the invisible one within the all." Or this: "I am the first and the last. I am the honored one and the scorned one. I am the whore and the holy one. I am the wife and the virgin. I am the mother and the daughter." As Orthodox Christianity rejected female imagery and gradually excluded women from positions of leadership, Gnostic churches continued to encourage female leadership. Of course, they were severely criticized by the Orthodox Church Fathers. According to Pagels, Bishop Irenaeus notes with dismay that women are especially attracted to heretical groups. He admitted that even in his own district, the Gnostic teacher Marcus had attracted, quote, "many foolish women," unquote, including the wife of one of Irenaeus' own deacons. Marcus invited women to prophesy and even to act as priests in celebrating the Eucharist. Tertullian expresses similar outrage at the Gnostics. He writes, "These heretical women, how audacious they are. They have no modesty. They are bold enough to teach, to engage in argument, to enact exorcisms, to undertake cures, and, it may be, even to baptize." Orthodox Christianity made many theological decisions which would strengthen the centralized power of the church. One of the most crucial and politically ingenious theological decisions had to do with the nature of God. God was determined to be a creator outside the creation rather than within it, except in the person of Jesus. Jesus' resurrection had to be accepted literally because only the apostles were supposed to have seen him after he arose. In this way, only by tracing one's authority through the bishops back to the apostles and thus to Jesus, only that way could one have access to God. In case you think this kind of thinking is peculiar to the 4th century, take a look at some of the bumper stickers today, which say that Jesus is the one way to God. Gnostics who experience the divine within themselves and refuse to accept a literal interpretation of the resurrection did not really need the bishops or the apostles or even a resurrected Jesus in order to have access to God. So they were labeled heretics. It may be, as Pagel suggests, that the decisions of the Orthodox Church enabled Christianity to survive. Today, however, it may be that our survival as human beings depends upon the assertion of the very principles once espoused by Gnostic heretics: the freedom to pursue self-knowledge and the use of a democratic process in human relations. Principles that should sound very familiar to Unitarian Universalists.